Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, one of our favorite topics, how to attract pest-eating amphibians to your property to eat your bad bugs, because every frog and or toad on your property will eat tens of thousands of insects in a single season. It is organic pest control on a stick, and we'll put it on a stick for you after lots of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Josh, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how's it going?
I am just fine today. Josh, how are you, sir?
Doing good. I got a strange question for you here.
Where are you?
Oh, I'm in Clarksville, Tennessee, and I've got a hackberry tree behind my house, and it is unbelievably infested with woolly aphids. When it got warm last year, they were all over the place, and they leave this stuff they lovingly call honeydew all over everything, and then a black mold grows in it. Everything underneath it or near it just gets covered and it's black. This is up close to the house near the porch. So the porch is all black. All the limbs of the tree are black. I would like to get rid of these things as well as I possibly could without using chemicals. I called the Ag Extension agent. They said I could use something called imidacloprid that I could put it in the ground and it'll be absorbed and into the tree and it would just kill them as they landed on the leaves. If I could avoid doing that if possible, I'd like to because I want to plant a garden nearby, and I'd hate to be killing all the bees nearby. So
yeah, no, you'd kill the bees by putting the systemic into the hackberry tree. It wouldn't even have to go further than that. No, systemics are one of the biggest problems in the world of chemical insecticides. So you actually have woolly adelgids. You have these furry aphids.
Yes, they're white and they're fuzzy all over and they fly around. And I mean, they're unbelievably overwhelming on this tree. They're just all over it.
Have you tried blowing them off the tree with?
I have.
And?
We tried blowing them off the tree with just spraying water with them. And that just makes them go out from the tree and then they fly right back to it.
And you're using a regular garden hose with regular household water pressure.
That is correct. And as soon as you hit the leaves, oh, man, the whole sky around them is just full of these white, fuzzy, flying creatures. Mm-hmm. And then you think, well, they'll just go away. They come right back. In fact, most of the hackberry trees nearby, they're infested with them, too. I've heard of people trying to treat the tree leaves with some type of a soap, but I can't find any evidence that that's something that would work. And I would hate to hurt my tree by just experimenting with it.
No. Okay, first suggestion. Go out and buy or rent a pressure washer.
Okay.
And up the ante. I mean, no offense, but you're trying to shoot these things with a .22. And
right. All
you're doing is making them angry. You know, okay. You want to go out and get the water pressure equivalent of an AK-47, which I can only think is going to be really emotionally satisfying. And then you can also use it to blow all the honeydew off the surfaces.
That is true.
So that is my first suggestion. Yes, there are insecticidal soaps. That's not the treatment of choice for these woolly adelgids. The treatment of choice for them is what's called horticultural oil. And that comes in two forms. The old school horticultural oil, which is essentially a refined petroleum product, but it's even approved for organic agriculture if it's used correctly. You spray in the winter, dormant oil, dormant season. It's a very heavy oil. It smothers all the overwintering eggs and nymphs and all that kind of stuff. During the season, there is a much more refined vegetable-based oil. Also under the generic horticultural oil, but this might be called summer oil or summer spray, something like that. But I got to tell you, though, we talk about this all the time. The pressure has to be intense. You really got to blow these suckers off the plant. It's really got to sting your hand if the water pressure hits you. And in your situation with them fouling surfaces and stuff, I mean, this is a machine that it would pay you to own. And again, I can't think of anything more fun than going out on a beautiful spring morning and blasting these suckers out of the tree.
Absolutely. I would thoroughly enjoy doing that. I hate these things so bad.
Well, I think God made pressure washers for you, man. This seems to be your destiny. And if any of the other infested trees are nearby, you know, maybe give them a hosing down, too. But once you get this tree clean and keep it clean, I think they're going to flock to greener pastures.
Okay.
All right, Josh?
Hey, I'm excited to try this. It's going to be fun.
Exactly. That's what I was hoping you'd think. All right, take care, man.
I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Bye. 1-888-346-9499. Scott, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How you doing?
I am doing just fine today. Thank you. Scott, how are you, sir?
Sitting in a truck waiting for a Navico to load.
So I won't ask you where your truck is sitting. Where is your garden?
It's in Elmira, New York.
All right. What can we do for Scott in New York?
I've been told I overcompost, and I didn't know you could overcompost.
Well, you know, that's an interesting topic. I'll ask you what you mean by that, but I'll tell you that my good friend, the great garden writer Adrian Higgins, who's the garden editor for the Washington Post, just interviewed a gardener from Ireland who felt that after years and years, decades of adding compost to his garden, he was afraid his soil was getting, quote, heavy. Now, tell me what your friends are thinking.
Well, they say I go overboard. I live in a dead-end residential street that's been in my family for 20-odd years. I got a garden in my backyard. My yard's 50 by 318. The last 60 feet is all vegetable gardening. What I like to do is I got one of those DIY field and brush chipper backs that you drive along to pick up the leaves. I've got 7 leaf-bearing trees in my yard and 14 pine needle trees. And that machine is a godsend. I put the pine needles in one spot where I plant my tomatoes because they're an acid-loving plant. And that's where I suck them up and put them in a pile. The pile ends up being about 10 feet deep of solid pine needles. I cover them with a product called Milarganite. I'm sure you've heard of that. And then the rest of the garden, I vacuum up all the leaves. I put all my leaves in, cover it with Milarganite. And then every layer I put on a batch of Milarganite, and I put lime down. Basically, when I get done, that 60-foot section of garden has almost 10 feet of solid leaves on it. And then I leap a sprinkler on and water it for a week, let the stuff decompose, and I go out there usually about January and I till it all in. My soil level on that garden is about 2 feet higher than the rest of the yard now. And I get tomatoes plants that come up in the middle of January. I picked potatoes in the middle of January because the ground temperature is about 60 to 70 degrees. It's so hot underneath that.
When you build up a pile of organic matter that's anywhere close to 10 feet high, you're making really hot compost, as you know. Not only hot compost in that the finished product is superior to stuff that just sits around, but as you found out, it heats to a very good internal temperature. When you make a pile that big, everything happens much more quickly. It's filled with microorganisms. I'm curious as to why you're using Milarganite. Milarganite, in my world, is not approved for use in organic gardening, because I'm sure you're a smart guy. You know what Milarganite is.
But it says right on the back, flowers and vegetable gardens, it says it's 100% natural organic fertilizer right on the back, though.
Well, you know, it is and it isn't. First of all, it is human waste, but it's not composted. They just heat it. They just dry it out. And it comes from the sewer system of Milwaukee, and people put things in the sewers, as I'm sure you're aware, that don't belong there. And there are all sorts of issues with the pharmaceuticals that people are taking now. So the bottom line is you could not be approved as organic when you use that. And I presume you're using it as a source of nitrogen. And in New York State, where you are, I would suggest because you're heating your pile so much, have you ever thought about using horse manure instead? Because your pile is so hot, it would burn up any weed seeds that were in the manure.
I'd never heard that, using horse manure. I thought manure is manure. I didn't know there was a big difference.
Well, the preferred manures are from herbivores, not meat-eating animals. That's why We always have to warn people on the show not to try to use cat waste and dog waste.
No.
If your results are anywhere near what you're saying, if your vegetables are delicious and beautiful, your flowers are great, you've extended your season because your ground is so warm, then my only suggestion to you is to find a local stable and use their manure instead of the Milorganite, and then I'll give you an A+.
Okay.
Keep on building that huge pile, man.
Thank you, sir. That's all I wanted to know.
All right. You take care, sir.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear in the Oklahoma City area twice on Earth Day Eve. That's Thursday, April 21st. I'll give a talk on composting on the University of Central Oklahoma campus at 3 p.m. Thursday afternoon, and then promote pollinators in a KGOU event at the fabulous Myriad Botanic Gardens that evening. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with easy ways to attract frogs and toads and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, I have already enjoyed the sounds of spring peepers in the nighttime air. I know that my little toadies are busy laying their toady eggs in little vernal ponds, and that they and their children will then proceed to eat many of my garden insects this season. How do you get these incredibly effective, and I think personally kind of cute, natural pest controllers to come to your place? We'll tell you after lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Martha, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Martha. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am just ducky. Where is Martha great?
I'm in the Germantown neighborhood of Philadelphia.
A great old section of the city. What can we do for Martha in Germantown?
Well, I have an ailanthus tree that I would like to get rid of, and I'm hoping that there's an organic solution to this.
The tree of heaven. This is the tree that you see growing up out of the top of abandoned buildings. If you cut it down to a stump, it regrows from the stump. I believe it sends up underground suckers, so it kind of creeps sideways. Where is your heavenly tree?
It's in the back of my property, and it's growing basically out of a curb.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, isn't it?
On our fence line.
Yeah. This is the new nature. These are the plants that are tough. Now, I presume your big issue is keeping it out of your gardens.
Yeah, but it's growing really rapidly, and it's going to consume all of my sunlight pretty soon, and I'm excited to get rid of it as soon as possible.
Okay. So what I'm going to recommend is the same thing we generally recommend for running bamboo, except in your case, it's going to be a lot easier, which is the rope-a-dope method.
Okay.
How tall is the tree right now?
I want to say it's about 25 feet tall already.
Whoa.
It's growing really rapidly. About 3 years ago, when we first bought our house, it was a twig, essentially, and it's grown really, really quickly.
So you've not ever done anything to control it?
No, not yet. I mean, I didn't get around to it, and before I knew it, it's enormous already.
Good Lord. Do you need a chainsaw now?
Perhaps, yes.
Okay. Well, I was thinking like a little 10-footer.
No.
Okay, so
a little bit bigger.
What I'm going to suggest is you talk to all your friends, find somebody who's got a chainsaw, who knows how to notch a tree, and have them come over and make sure that they do it correctly and that it doesn't fall into any electrical wires or anything like that. And then, if you want, you can go out and you can buy a nice little electric chainsaw. You know, they're not powerful enough for taking down big trees, but they're good for small uses. You can even find them that are rechargeable. When the tree regrows, you let it grow until it produces its first true leaves, and then you cut it again. If you had started this when you first noticed it 3 years ago, when you could have just gone out and cut it down with a bow saw, you probably would have almost eliminated the tree completely by now. What would be coming up out of the ground would be like almost like grass shoots.
Oh.
So
well, it wasn't on my radar at that point.
So, yeah, you got to get it cut down by somebody who knows what they're doing, because a tree that size is now dangerous. But then after that, you can probably control the new growth with a good-sized bow saw. But the idea is there is a good amount of energy built up in that root system, but it has to collect new energy through the leaves. So you let the root system expend energy growing new woody growth. Then when the leaves appear, you cut it down again. So it used up a ton of calories, but it didn't get anything to eat. And then you just you just keep at it for a couple of years, and you eventually exhaust the root. And if it sends up shoots, if it sends up runners from underground, the way to keep them from coming back is if you can, rather than cut them off, saw them off, or prune them off, see if you can snap them off just by wiggling.
Oh, why is that?
Just some weird horticultural thing that involves some sort of plant hormone that if you snap them off, it does not trigger the instinct to regrow.
Okay.
And help rot out the stump.
Okay.
All right.
And I should expect for this to take 2 or 3 years.
Right. Or you can borrow a time machine, go back and get it while it was small, and it wouldn't be happening now.
I think I can handle this. I'll keep an eye on it, and I'll keep on top of it.
Oh, and at the very least, if you just cut it down once a year, it won't get a chance to shade your garden.
Okay.
All right.
Well, that sounds better than using the nasty chemical that I was reading about.
Yes, please don't do that. You know, you're in a nice environment there. Let's keep it nice.
Okay.
All right, Martha. Good luck.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Carl, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for making it, Carl. Where are you, sir?
I'm calling from a small seashore community in southern New Jersey that is called Stone Harbor, New Jersey.
Oh, we know Stone Harbor in the Philadelphia area. We wouldn't consider that.
Absolutely. It's a great town. It's great in the wintertime. It's great in the summertime. It's truly a great place to live, except for the reason why I'm calling today. You probably know sometimes these coastal towns have saltwater flooding from the back bays. And my house is situated in the Bay Block. And two or three times during the winter, the tidal flutter, you know, come over the bulkheads in the block and flood the street. And I get this salt water all over my grass. I get the salt water in my gardens. I have a raised vegetable garden. It gets covered in salt water. And then eventually, just like always, the water leaves. And that happens two to three times a winter. So as I was out back just the other day with my dog, I'm thinking I have to get into my all of my gardens. I'm thinking, is there anything I should be doing with the soil since all that salt water has been in there? And I didn't know if there's something I should be doing to try to mitigate any problems that I might have with salt water and dirt and roots and those types of things.
Yeah, well, the cure for salt water is fresh water. As soon as the salt water event is over, the best thing you can do is try to flush the salts out of your soil.
That's just hose water is what you're talking about then.
That's all you got, right?
Other than rain, if I'm lucky that it rains the next day, how long do you think I would have to run the water on the grass and on the garden areas?
Well, you know, you have sandy soil. I mean, you have to have sandy soil no matter how much you've improved it. What does the grass typically look like?
My grass right now is still brown.
Do you know what kind of grass you have?
I have kind of a mixture of an Azoiza, and in the areas that I have kind of supplemented, I supplemented with some type of tall fescue.
Oh, okay. Well, the Zoysia grass is not going to be harmed by this. When Zoysia grass or any plant is dormant, it's not absorbing the salt water.
Oh.
If the flood happened while the Zoysia was green, it could affect it negatively. But when the Zoysia is dormant, it's having the least possible effect. I also want you to talk to your local extension agent. It's my understanding this whole thing with salinity of soil can be moderated somewhat by you playing around with the pH. And I don't know the details off the top of my head. Maybe you'd be adding a little bit of lime or wood ash, or maybe you'd go the other way and use a little bit of peat moss. But there are ways to bind the atoms of the salt so that they're not so available to plants. There's little tricks you can play. But great. I would urge you to expand the Zoysia this spring.
I really like the look of it. That's why whenever I have spots that I'm replacing, I always put the tall fescue in because I don't really like the look of the Zoysia. But I guess in terms of a long-term plan, it's probably the best for what I have.
Especially
because
for
the flooding is not going away.
Right, and especially for a place that you're mostly going to be at in the summer when the Zoysia is at its best. Now, as to your raised bed vegetable gardens, that's easy. They're not raised up nearly high enough. You know, this is just a matter of scale. How high is the water mark when these floods occur?
Well, the water mark is probably 2.5 feet. It's knee, a little above knee.
Okay. So I don't know if you've seen one of the newest things. I see it in garden centers and a lot of catalogs, is these elevated planting beds. They're on stilts, like many of the better houses down the shore.
Okay.
There's two advantages to that. First of all, like with the better built houses, the water just goes underneath them and doesn't affect the soil. The other advantage is as we get older, who wants to be bending down even to a raised bed that's a foot off the ground? These things have all the plants right at the perfect level for you to work with them. They're easy to keep weed free. You could have them right out there, quote, on top of the Zoysia grass bed. They could even coexist.
Yep. You build them in like rows then. So
you build them like regular raised beds. You make them 4x4 or 4x8, and you leave 2 feet of walking space between them. And because the area is raised up and you filled it with a very specialized soil mix, it'll be much more productive than a garden close to the ground.
Good suggestion. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. Always love the show.
Good luck, Carl.
We'll see you down the shore this summer. Thanks, sir.
Keep my room ready.
I will. Thank you. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Audrey, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Audrey. Thank you. How are you?
Fabulous. I am just fantastic with a sore back from moving my mushroom soil.
Oh, okay. Where did Audrey get her sore back?
I've got 5 yards of mushroom soil I had dumped right next to my driveway, and it's sort of on the Pachysandra. And my husband's furious. He says I bought the wrong thing.
Right.
That I should have bought topsoil when all I wanted to do was amend my garden so that I can start some lettuces and things as opposed to just flowers.
Okay.
And I live in clay, rocky soil with lots of shade. And I figured whatever I didn't use in my garden, I could sprinkle on whatever kind of green lawn we have, which is basically moss, Pachysandra, and whatever wants to grow.
Okay, so where are you?
In Mechanicsville, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Your landscape sounds like it's very damp, shady, and acidic, so I don't think you're going to be able to vegetable garden there.
Well, I just planted some spring lettuces, and then when they go, I'm just going to fill it in with flowers.
Okay, because if the lettuces don't get enough sun, they will still grow, but they won't be especially healthy to eat when greens are grown in a very shady environment. They get what's called nitrate buildup, the stuff that people don't want in their bacon, nitrates and nitrites. And it just makes sense. Sunlight is what makes plants energetic and good for us, you know, and fuels all of the things that we're eating them for. Now, let's get back to your pile. When you bought your mushroom soil, did you specify whether it would be fresh or aged?
No, I didn't.
So does it stink and is it hot?
It doesn't smell that bad. I mean, it smells a little bit, but when we were going to get some rain last week, my husband put a tarp on top. And when I took the tarp off to, like, start moving it around, it was kind of smoky when I put my shovel in it.
Yes. Now, but where did you get it? Did you buy it from a mushroom farm or a garden center?
No. A local guy delivered it.
Right. A local guy. Yeah. Hey, mushroom soil, man. Yeah. Yeah. It's like the Good Humor truck's right behind me. Mushroom soil. So you really need to know whether this stuff is fresh or aged. When it comes out of the mushroom house, after it's grown a couple of runs of mushrooms, this soil is very dark, very rich, very hot, and hot in the horticultural sense because the horse manure that's used to grow the mushrooms, that's the predominant thing in the mix, is horse manure and ground up corn cobs and some other things like green sand. But there's a lot of fresh horse manure. That's what heats up the mushroom houses, really, is just the hotness of that manure. So when it's fresh out of the mushroom house and when it has a distinctive smell, and if you put your hand in the middle of the pile and it warms up your hand, that's too hot to use around plants. You get the most bulk when you buy fresh. Let's say that is a big pile of fresh mushroom soil. You leave it alone to age down, it will decrease in size by half. It will lose its smell. It will lose its heat. And then it's a good soil amendment if you know what you're dealing with. Sometimes these mushroom soils can be kind of alkaline. If it came from a commercial mushroom farm, it can be loaded with fungicides because that's what they often do to kill the mushroom spores, you know, because otherwise, you know, they gave you mushroom soil, you'd be growing white button mushrooms. So some farms sterilize it in a big steamer, and those are the farms that you want to get your mushroom soil from. But others spray it with fungicides to kill the spores. And that's really not something you want to be handling or inhaling or have around. Certainly, I don't want you to handle any of this without gloves.
Oh, I know that, yes.
So are there other things you can do with this? Can you move it away from the plants and let it cook down for a while? Can you get a hold of this guy? And 'cause
I can just wheelbarrow it one wheelbarrow at a time back in the woods and dump it.
And if you dump it in an accessible area, this time next year it'll be perfect.
Oh, brilliant.
It will have aged down and all of it will have become a much more towards neutral.
Okay. Ooh, my husband was right.
Yeah, well, you don't want to buy bulk material like that without asking a lot of questions. If you had gone to our website, if you had gone to youbetyourgarden.org, gone to Garden Answers A to Z and clicked on M for mushroom soil, we hold your hand through the whole process, all the different types and the questions to ask.
Okay. Oh, well.
All right, but no, I mean, it's better you learned now. Yeah, and I wouldn't eat that stuff, and please don't handle it without gloves.
Okay. Okay. All right, well, thank you very much.
All right, good luck, Audrey.
You too, bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and kind of apologize, and at the same time emphasize that I'm really not kidding when I say that I am dyslexic. A couple of weeks ago, every time I promoted our upcoming bit on soil solarization, I said this works great if you can give your garden a week off. Must have said it 4 or 6 times easy, when, of course, when we got to the question of the week, we explained soil solarization takes an entire summer season. Little more than a week. But don't go looking for all the details about dyslexia just yet, because we'll be right back with easy ways to attract frogs and toads and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm WHYY, and you're listening to Philadelphia in Mike McGrath.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to a very interesting question of the week. How to attract pest-eating amphibians, specifically frogs and toads, to your garden and landscape to eat your bad bugs for you. Toads will even eat your cuke beetles. They don't care. They'll eat all your pests. And we'll tell you how to attract them after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Randy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Randy. How are you, sir?
I am fantastic.
Oh, that's great. Where is Randy Fantastic?
In Edmond, Oklahoma.
Edmond, Oklahoma. I will see you guys on Earth Day Eve. What can we do for Randy Fantastic?
Well, I was planning on making a hydroponic garden, and all of the research I've done on it, I'm choosing the, I think it's called the Kratky method with the rafters floating above the water. And everywhere I'm looking, they talk about nutrient mixes, and all of them are chemical-based. And I was trying to find something.
And not only chemicals. I just had an email exchange with a guy who he felt he could never get the wilt out of his raised bed garden. So he's turned to hydroponics to grow his tomatoes, and he has terrible blossom end rot because he can't get enough calcium into the solution. And I asked him to send me a link to the fertilizer he's using. And oh, man, this stuff is the nastiest of chemical fertilizers, you know, like ammonium nitrate, all high explosives, all real nasty stuff. That's one reason I've always stayed away from hydroponics is, first of all, it's tremendously artificial. None of these plants like having their feet constantly wet. But almost all of the basic growing types are highly chemicalized. Now, tell me why you're interested in hydroponics.
The area that I live, the soil is clay and sand, and all it really grows is sandburst.
Okay, so are you going to grow your hydroponics inside?
Either inside or on my covered deck. Still gets a lot of sun.
You know, 8 hours of full sun a day?
Probably.
Yeah, okay. And I don't know about the viability of hydroponics outside. That's a new one to me. I have seen hydroponics in old warehouses that have glass roofs. But if you're going to do that, why don't you just get containers, make up a really nice potting soil and compost, and grow them in dirt the way God intended?
I think it seemed more interesting to me, the hydroponics.
If you really want to pursue this idea, there is a variation of hydroponics that's more complicated, but that I can get my head behind, and that's called aquaponics. And that involves fish, like these tilapia fish.
Oh, okay. I think I've seen some on that.
Right. So you've got the plants growing in some sort of thing to hold their roots in the soil, what we would have called rock wool back in the old days. And then underneath in the water, you've got live fish going around, and they're nibbling away. I believe there's aquatic plants in there that they can feed off of. And then their fish poop feeds the plants. And it's a completely closed circle. And obviously, this is like having a small-scale farm where you raise your own chickens, except in this case, you're getting fish instead of chickens and, you know, I guess you would get eggs. You wouldn't want to use them the same way. But but aquaponics avoids the whole issue of chemical fertilizers. Because I'll tell you, when I was trying to help this guy out, now I forget where he lives, but I looked not only at the content of these things, which was like tremendously brutal, but the prices seemed really extravagantly, enormously high. Yeah, I think you could grow better-looking plants more naturally in large containers for the same price or less. But if you wanted to go and play around with growing in water, I would urge you to look at aquaponics instead. I believe we interviewed an author about a year ago who wrote an entire book just on aquaponics, and that was the name of the book. So you should be able to find that pretty easily.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you very much.
Good luck whichever way you go, sir, and I'll see you on Earth Day Eve.
All righty.
Take care.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Susan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I am just ducky today. Susan, how are you?
Well, I'd be really good if I could get rid of these groundhogs and these voles that are just tearing up my yard.
Ooh, those are some serious creatures. Where is Susan's infested yard?
We are in northern Burlington County in Columbus Bordentown area, New Jersey.
Okay. So you have voles, V-O-L-E-S, which are little shrew-like creatures that make trails through the grass and eat the roots of plants. And you have groundhogs, which are much larger creatures that make very...
Oh, I'm sorry. Chipmunks and voles.
Okay, yeah. Slight size difference between a chipmunk and a groundhog.
That'd be a big haul.
So chipmunks, you know, I know they cause a lot of mischief for people, but I find them cute, and they don't really do any damage at my house. Do you have, like, a stone wall or a rock garden or something that's attracting them?
I'm not quite sure what it is. They popped up about last year. Just the base around the house, which is concrete, but we have about a four-foot flower bed that surrounds about three sides of the house, and they really enjoy it in there.
And you've seen the chipmunks actually doing this?
Yeah, we've actually caught a few, and we've kind of relocated them to a better location, but there's still a few friends that are left behind, and they've eaten my bulbs this year and last year, and that, along with the voles, they've left a lot of holes and tunnels all over the flower bed.
I don't know really what chipmunks eat. I don't think of them as bulb eaters. That's more squirrels and voles.
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen the voles, the little shrew-like, mice-like creatures?
Yeah, a couple of them.
Okay, so the first question is, do you have bird feeders out?
Not anymore. We did. It was attracting them, so they're gone now. They're gone.
So you had just regular seed feeders that were spilling all this schmutz all over the ground.
Right.
Yeah.
They loved it. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And you say they're in a flower bed out front.
Yeah, they're in the flower bed. And we've tried a lot of things over the end of last year, the season, going into the winter, and then they started in full force already the last few weeks. So we've used castor oil pellets and
good.
Graduated to straight castor oil down the holes.
You say you're using liquid castor oil. Is this a liquid sold in a garden center as a mole and vole repellent?
Both. So we've used the granulars. We've actually used just regular over-the-counter castor oil.
But didn't you notice that the over-the-counter castor oil didn't have any smell?
It didn't have a smell.
That's how it works.
Okay.
That's one mistake that you've made. All of this evidence that castor oil repels underground creatures goes back to the days before the stuff people would take for supposed health reasons was deodorized.
Okay.
So you want the odorous, and the only way to get that these days is to buy the mole and vole repellents that are specially made for sale in garden centers. Now, you'll notice that there are two different kinds, that there are the different pellets, and then there are liquid versions that you spray. The idea is not to pour it down the holes. That's not the concept. You want to cover the bed with this stuff. And then if it's the pellets, water it in, or if it's the liquid, you want to saturate the entire bed side to side, front to back. Because what you're doing is you're imparting a nasty smell in the ground. And then if there's another place nearby at somebody else's house, they will abandon the smelly house and they will go infest your neighbor's flower beds. Now, here's another idea that just occurred to me, because all you did was put your bird feeders away. You didn't throw them out. I know that, right?
Right.
So why don't you set them up someplace else?
Okay.
Where these creatures can't do any harm and get them out of your flower beds that way. So if you heavily scent the area with the right kind of castor oil, and when you look at these products now in the garden center, buy the ones with the highest level of active ingredient because they will smell the worst underground.
Okay.
And then set up the bird feeders in another area where you really don't care if these creatures hang out. And the final question is this flower bed mulched with like wood mulch?
It was the last couple of years. This year we haven't done it yet, so.
Okay, good, good. Three things. Set up the bird feeder in another area as a trap crop. Really saturate the flower bed. And do not mulch it with anything for this season. They rely on that mulch for protective cover from predators.
Okay.
And I think that should do it.
Okay. I'll give it a try.
All right. You take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. attracting amiable and advantageous amphibians. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started by reading this week's froggy question.
Sure, Mike. Gary in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware writes, back in March, you had a caller on your show who said she was being overrun by toads and frogs and wanted to try and discourage them from hanging around her house. She should be rejoicing at her success. Amphibians in general are having a tough time in our modern environment. According to the United States Geological Survey, they are disappearing at an alarming rate, even from protected habitats, and nobody is quite sure why, my habitat included. The back of my property line is a wetland boundary, and I've noticed that it's gotten a lot quieter out there in the past 10 years. I try to respect the environment, and the property is mostly undisturbed. No mowing, no chemicals, minimal leaf raking. Behind the house is a little decorative pond that is best described as two overgrown puddles with a small circulator pump that runs 24/7 to discourage mosquitoes and attract wildlife. It's the only water in the neighborhood that isn't brackish. In hot weather, it's topped off by the drip water from our air conditioner. But alas, there is no longer a single bullfrog harumphing on summer nights and only a few peepers peeping in the spring. Where have they gone? I miss their cheerful cacophony. P.S. On a trip to Chiapas, Mexico, I learned that the toad is revered by indigenous people as a symbol of new life because in the autumn it disappears into an underground burrow, death, and reemerges in the spring, resurrection. Mike, this man has serious toad and frog envy. Can we help him?
Absolutely. Back in 1994, when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, we won the first of four consecutive Best of Show awards at the Philadelphia Flower Show for a major exhibit that was dominated by hundreds of different hot pepper plants and ringed with a little runway filled with toads to demonstrate natural pest control. In an article we published the same year, we explained that researchers had found that a single toad can eat tens of thousands of garden pests every season, including grasshoppers, cutworms, slugs, the spruce budworm, the plum curculio, and even cucumber beetles, an insect that tastes so bitter that birds and mantises won't go near them.
So you learned a lot about attracting amphibians.
Yeah, and some of the best and most simplest advice came from Craig Tufts, manager of the Backyard Wildlife Habitat Program for the National Wildlife Federation. He said you need to provide three important things: water, shady shelter, and an absolute absence of pesticides.
Our listener seems to have all three.
Well, it sure seems like he's not using any pesticides. But his, quote, two-puddle pond might be too small if he wants froggies to breed and sing to him in season. A curator at the Oklahoma Museum of Natural History we interviewed for that story stressed that frogs need large, deep bodies of water in which to lay their eggs. And, you know, I just had an experience in Fredericksburg, Virginia that seemed to really prove that point. There is a big retention pond between a hotel I was staying at and the expo center where I was speaking. Very little greenery in the area. Lots of pavement and roadways. But the water was full of spring peepers. Instead of watching TV, I went out and sat by the pond with a glass of wine in the evening. And an expert from the North Carolina Natural Science Museum added that toads don't like to breed in ponds that have pumps or fountains, that it's better to add the non-toxic larvicide BTI to the water to control mosquito breeding.
And third would be those shady spots.
Right. Toads really need deep, dark, wet, shady places to hide in during the day. The ideal toad abode is a little depression you dig in a damp, shady spot that you then place a long, wide board on top of, supported by a few bricks. Then cover that board with soil, old carpet, potted plants, whatever. You can even buy pre-made toad houses. Just make sure you place them in full, all-day, damp shade.
Right, because if you put them in full sun, they'd be toad microwaves.
And another researcher we interviewed from the Toronto Zoo added that ferns might be the favorite land plant to put in for amphibians. They naturally grow in wet, shady spots, and they provide excellent protection from predators.
Now, it's possible, maybe even likely, that our listener does have toads, but doesn't realize how many because they don't peep or croak like frogs. His environment seems mostly perfect for them.
And toads are mainly active at night. I mostly see mine in my raised beds in the late evening. But if he wants to go for the noisy, froggy gold, he can place a light out by his improved, enlarged, and deepened pond to attract the insects that these amphibians need to breed. Point the light down towards the ground so it doesn't cause light pollution and interfere with stargazing.
If it works, he can go out frog and toad gazing instead.
Well, that sure was some great information about attracting pest eaters now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail with links to more articles about frog and toad attraction, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to foil my froggies if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
Please, please, please include your location. Oh, it's so important. Please, please, please.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location. And where you will find the answers to all those garden questions you are going to email us. Audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz keeps our website wet, damp, and shady. Assisted by that savage she-devil, Sarah Kazar. Non-warty Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our bug-eating editor is Al Banks. Our intern, Eileen Kelly, says that she is currently a student at Villanova, and so she just wins, period. I'm your truly dyslexic host, Mike McGrath. And when I have trouble sleeping and a crisis of faith, I sit up all night wondering if there really is a dog. Until I can see you again next week. First-year gardening often resembles the opening of Raiders of the Lost Ark. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to avoid running away from a giant boulder as you try and grow your first tomatoes. Plus your fabulous phone calls.